I'm Lena Alialoro.
This is Scott Fane.
This is Linda Olsen-Austin.
This is Owen Bastable.
I'm Cicely Rogers.
I'm Lisa Lewis.
I'm Brian Pritchett.
This is Rebecca Nate.
I'm Robert Barnford.
Volunteer-run, community-powered. This is the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, New York University suspends pro-Palestine protesters.
More possible budget cuts in Oregon public schools.
And Hawaii may become the fifth state in the union to recognize civil unions. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 25th, 2009. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Mia Lewis.
A recent report on the Portland police praises their treatment of detained suspects but calls for greater accountability. The report from the Independent Police Assessment Resource Center recommended greater restrictions on the use of non-lethal weapons and improved medical responses for wounded suspects. The study included an assessment of the 2004 fatal shooting of a 24-year-old man, citing the Portland police's failure to provide critical medical treatment as a contributing factor. Contributions to the study say that this man's preventable death highlights the importance of immediate medical care for wounded suspects and a more responsible use of non-lethal weapons.
Last week, the Port of Astoria's former director pled guilty to violating the Federal Clean Air and Water Act in 2005, a charge which could land him in prison for up to 3 years. Peter Guerin was in charge of disposing of dredged materials from a cruise ship dock enlargement in the Port of Astoria, which he initially tried to dump in the middle of the Columbia River. The Army Corps of Engineers determined that the materials were contaminated and required the port authorities to store them in containment pools on land. Guerin knew that the pools were not large enough to hold the contaminated materials, so he allowed a gate to be opened that leaked dredge into the Columbia. The Environmental Protection Agency conducted a 2-year investigation into Guerin's involvement in the dredging violation, ultimately leading to the federal charges and fines of over $100,000 against the Port of Astoria.
Women's shelters, counselors, and others who help domestic violence and sexual assault victims are dreading the latest round of state budget cuts. Hayden Almiana, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, reports.
Access to safety and shelter is critical when you're in an abusive relationship, but state budget cuts mean less funding for emergency shelters, sexual assault counseling, and outreach for domestic violence victims. The governor has proposed that the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Service Fund be trimmed 10%, although advocates say it's already underfunded. And Carrie Naughton, with the Partnership for Safety and Justice, says in a shaky economy, the need for these types of services grows.
The National Institute of Justice actually found that the rate of violence against women increases as the rate of male unemployment increases. And we think it's important to remember that more than a third of domestic violence assaults are witnessed by children.
Naughton says in 2007 there were more than 17,000 requests for emergency shelter that could not be met, and one in six Oregon women is a rape victim. Counselors and other service providers will be in Salem on Friday to make their case, asking state lawmakers to spare the program. This is Hayden Almina in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, reporting for KBOO Evening News.
The Oregon legislature wants to cut $106 million from public schools this year. This is in addition to the $61 million that has already been cut, which has led to layoffs and lost school days in many Oregon school districts. In response, a group of education advocates have staged a protest in Salem and started an online petition to be delivered to the legislature this Monday. Holly Pruitt, a representative from the group Stand for Children, explains the issue.
On President's Day, Stand for Children organized 5,000 Oregonians to go down to the state capitol to tell the legislature that we knew it was tough times, but we wanted them to protect kids in schools. And folks who went down there were really disappointed when 2 days later the chief budget writers announced that they were looking at another $106 million of cuts to school districts across the state on top of the $61 million that had already been cut from the current school year, which was looking like an average of about 5 lost school days per district spread around the state. And so they said, you know, we've got to do something to keep making our voice heard in Salem. And so Stand for Children members launched an online petition. It's www.stand.org/nomorecuts. to let folks who wanted to send that message again to the legislature that schools and kids need to be a priority during these tough times could sign on to that petition, forward it to all of their friends, and then on Monday we're going to take all those signatures down to Salem. In the first 36 hours, we've had 5,000 people sign on, which just shows that there's such a strong priority out there in the community to do everything that we can to keep the school year whole. And that's, by the way, a message that ultimately needs to be taken not only to the state legislature, but also to each school board, so that when school boards are dealing with having to tighten their belts further, which is just inevitable during this recession, that they're prioritizing instructional time for kids and that school days are the last things that get cut rather than being the first on the list. We know that, in the $61 million of cuts that have happened already, that school districts in many communities have already had to start layoffs, close snow days that aren't going to be recovered. There are districts that do have some reserves they can tap into, but other districts that don't. And so the state is largely responsible for school funding in Oregon, and that's why we Stand for Children members wanted to have as many people as possible add their voices to call for no more cuts at the state level in the current school year. Portland Public Schools is still taking a look at how much of their reserves they can use and whether they're going to have to do any further cuts or not. Any reserves that get used in this school year just mean that there's less for the tougher times that are coming, we know, in the next budget cycle. The full revised budget for this current fiscal year will take place down in the legislature next week, which is why we want as many people as possible to sign on to www.stand.org/no more cuts by the end of the week so we can take their voices on that petition down to the Capitol next Monday.
That was Holly Pruitt, a representative for the education advocacy group Stand for Children.
There's been another setback for TriMet's new West Side Express service, which runs between Beaverton and Wilsonville. TriMet detected the defect this Friday during an inspection. Breakers began switching off as improperly installed wiring running along the wall of the rail car began smoking. This is the only rail car that has been affected by the problem. Buses are temporarily supplementing the rail service and will continue until the problem is resolved. Commuters should expect delays of 10 to 20 minutes for at least a few more days.
The Portland Department of Transportation plans to expand the bicycle boulevard system in the metro area. The program's goal is to overhaul busy neighborhood streets and optimize them for bike traffic. Bicycle boulevards typically include additional signs, roundabouts, and other types of pedestrian improvements to discourage motor vehicles. Susan Keel, director of the Portland Department of Transportation, says there will be a 15-mile expansion of bicycle boulevards in northeast, southeast, and southwest Portland. The focus will be on connecting already existing routes with different neighborhoods previously unserviced. Riders should expect the expansion to be complete by the end of 2009.
Today, the Oregon Court of Appeals ruled that judges can remove offenders from the state registry, even if it cannot be shown that there's no risk they will reoffend. This case involves a Clackamas County man convicted in 1993 of a misdemeanor sex offense against an 11-year-old girl. This is the first case to interpret a new law on sex abusers. The offender was sentenced to 3 years of probation and ordered to complete a sex offender treatment program. In 2006, he asked the Clackamas County Circuit Court to remove him from the registry and under a revised statute law that allows sex offenders convicted of only one misdemeanor to request removal 10 years after probation or parole. The trial judge denied the request despite testimony from a psychologist who said the risk of the offender reoffending was less than 1%. But the appeals court ruled that the standard set by the legislature to show an offender is not a threat did not require an offender to show that there was no possibility of another offense.
In the human cost of occupation in Iraq, multiple studies have estimated that over 1 million Iraqis have been killed since the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. The exact number of civilians killed is unknown, since neither the U.S. nor Iraqi governments do body counts of civilian casualties in the conflict. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by The Underground, hosted by the KBOO Youth Collective at 6. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 42.
The time is 5:11, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Blackwater USA, the infamous outfit of corporate mercenaries that became a worldwide symbol of George W.'s imperious war in Iraq, is gone. Not merely gone from Iraq, but entirely gone, kaput. Blackwater itself is no more. Unfortunately, it's gone in name only. Blackwater's privatized army that mired itself in scandal after scandal still exists, but it has rebranded itself with a new moniker. Henceforth, the corporation formerly known as Blackwater is to be called Z. That's spelled X-E, but is pronounced Z, which rhymes with we, as in, we got rid of that contaminated name so maybe no one will remember the stuff we did. Good luck with that. By whatever name, the company remains the target of 4 grand jury investigations in our country. It stands accused of tax fraud, improper use of force, arms trafficking, and overbilling taxpayers. It was fired from its security job with the State Department in January, and Iraq's government has since booted it out of that country entirely. It seems there's still a bit of resentment by Iraqis over that 2007 incident in which Blackwater guards gunned down 17 unarmed civilians. Nonetheless, the corporation's executives hope that the tiny, exotic name of Z will be big enough to hide its notorious past behind it. However, without a change in its corporate culture of anything goes, I'm guessing the world will be able to see right through the rebranding ploy. After all, it'll still be a far higher army with profit as its motivating ethic. This is Jim Hightower saying, by the way, I looked up Z in the dictionary. It's a chemical symbol for xenon, which is defined as a heavy, colorless, chemically inactive, monatomic, gaseous element present in the atmosphere. So, Blackwater is born again as a gaseous element.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
One of the aims of the economic stimulus package is to help states recover from their budget deficits, including making $15 billion available as early as Wednesday for states' Medicaid budgets. Some Republican governors are rejecting some of the money, citing that they don't want a temporary solution that their states will have to permanently pay for in the future. But some Republican governors are welcoming the stimulus as a good step towards solving their state's economic woes. As FSRN's Tanya Snyder reports, the differences became evident at this weekend's National Governors Association meeting.
6 Republican governors have said they're thinking of saying no to some of the stimulus funds. At least 4 of them have political ambitions of higher office. Governors Sarah Palin of Alaska, Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, Mark Sanford of South Carolina, and Rick Perry of Texas are all thought to be considering bids for national office in 2012. And all of them have spoken out against the stimulus. The governors are expected to take most of the money offered by the federal government. So far, Jindal is the only one to officially announce that he will turn down some of the money, though others are likely to follow. He spoke Monday after the governors met with President Obama.
I do appreciate the president acknowledging that there were legitimate concerns, legitimate issues when it comes to taking temporary federal dollars that could create permanent state spending obligations. For example, the money that we identified in Louisiana on Friday that we will not be accepting.
Jindal, along with Perry and Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour, have taken issue with a provision in the stimulus bill that requires a change in state law in order to receive some of the money. States would have to expand unemployment insurance coverage to include part-time workers. Governor Barbour says he'd rather give up the $50 million his state would get for unemployment benefits.
The unemployment insurance compensation scheme in the stimulus package would require us to have a future tax increase on employment. I mean, if you want more people working, you don't tax job creation. And we want more people working, not fewer people working.
Barber is worried that when the federal stimulus money runs out, the new requirement would continue to have an impact by raising unemployment taxes that businesses have to pay. But Andrew Stettner of the National Employment Law Project says that's not true.
It's structured to give them a huge surge of cash that will pay for years of these benefits up front. So actually, a number of these states, including some of the ones that are complaining, could actually see lower unemployment insurance taxes if they accepted the modernization funding.
Stettner says that if states do run into fiscal trouble down the line, there's nothing to stop them from repealing the unemployment expansion.
But in fact, we've had more than half the states pass these laws in the past, and they haven't repealed them because these are sensible, common sense reforms that reduce some really unnecessary inequities in the program. And when you fix them, you're able to do it at an affordable price.
States sign separate agreements with the federal government for each individual part of the stimulus, so they can cherry pick which elements to take and which to reject. And if they do reject some of that money, it can become available to other states, which sits just fine with Democratic Governor Ted Strickland of Ohio, a big supporter of the bill.
These governors may be meeting the needs of their citizens. There may not be unemployed people who need help or sick people who need health care or water and sewer projects that need to be built. And if they don't want to use those resources, we will use them well in Ohio.
Republicans in Congress, including many who voted against the stimulus bill, have been trumpeting the windfall of money coming to their districts, now praising the plan they tried to defeat. And most of the governors, including Republican Charlie Crist of Florida, are grateful for the money they say will save their states from painful tax increases and deep spending cuts.
These monies really are a blessing to help us.
Despite this overwhelming support, more governors may take issue with the varying strings attached to the stimulus money. The federal government is still in the process of releasing the rules states must follow in order to qualify for the funding. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
Two money managers who oversaw investments for Carnegie Mellon University and other institutions were arrested on Wednesday on charges of running an estimated $550 million decade-long swindle. Paul Greenwood and Stephen Walsh, managing general partners of broker-dealer WG Trading Company in Greenwich, Connecticut, faced charges of conspiracy, securities fraud, and wire fraud. The pair, both former part owners of the New York Islanders National Hockey League team, are accused of using client money as their personal piggy bank to fund lavish lifestyles, according to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The SEC and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission brought civil charges against the men and their companies. The SEC obtained a court-imposed asset freeze against the men and their affiliated entities. The two men appeared in court in Manhattan, where a judge set bail at $7 million to be secured by $1 million in cash or property, not from proceeds of the purported fraud. They had been suspended on February 12th for not disclosing financial records and failing to answer questions about promissory notes totaling hundreds of millions of dollars.
Over the weekend, the FBI rescued more than 45 children, some as young as 13, during a nationwide effort to save kids from the illegal sex trade. According to the FBI, Operation Cross Country 3 took action in 29 cities where almost 600 people were arrested and charged under a combination of state and federal laws on domestic trafficking of children for prostitution and solicitation. The coordinated effort was a part of the Innocence Lost National Initiative, launched in 2003 to address the issue of children forced into prostitution. Since then, near 700 children have been found.
President Obama's Department of Justice is refusing to pursue a request to recover millions of missing Bush-era White House emails. The National Security Archive, one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit to obtain the emails, says this lies in stark contrast to the Obama administration's call for greater transparency in government. The problem originated when the Bush administration did not install an electronic record-keeping system for emails sent within the White House. They subsequently refused to solve the issue until after 2005. Though some emails from this period have been recovered, the National Security Archive says the efforts thus far have been inadequate, and what is needed is an extensive attempt to recover the communiques in question.
A Hawaii Senate committee has deadlocked on a bill that would allow same-sex civil unions, but the legislation is still expected to move forward. The Senate Judiciary Committee heard more than 15 hours of testimony before voting 3-3 on a bill at 3 a.m. Wednesday. Democratic Senate leaders have said that if the panel became deadlocked, they would take the unusual step of yanking the measure from the committee and bringing it to a vote before the full Senate. At least 18 of the 25 senators have said they're in favor for civil unions. Hawaii's Republican governor has not stated her position on the bill, which, if passed, would make Hawaii the fifth state to allow same-sex civil unions.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in the matter of the U.S. versus Navajo Nations yesterday. The case concerns $600 million in royalties on coal leases that the Navajo, who are one of a number of coal-producing tribes, had with Peabody Energy. When the leases were up for renewal, the Navajo claimed that then U.S. Interior Secretary Donald Hodel undercut their negotiations. The tribe sued in 1993, claiming Hodel held secret meetings and that his actions were counter to the interests of the tribe, which, as a trustee, he was obligated to protect. The Supreme Court ruled for the government in 2003, saying that the Department of the Interior had protected the tribe's interests under the Indian Mineral Leasing Act. But a later ruling by the U.S. Court of Appeals said the Navajos had the right to present their arguments because the Supreme Court had not considered a network of laws, including the Navajo Hopi Rehabilitation Act and the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act.
New York University may expel 18 students after they staged a protest in support of residents of the Gaza Strip. 70 members of the pro-Palestine organization took over a student center for 1.5 days. Hundreds of people chanted in support of the protesters from outside the building. They demanded NYU award 13 scholarships to Gazan students and that the university donate excess supplies to the University of Gaza, which was badly damaged during the recent Israeli strike. The students are currently suspended and are awaiting a faculty hearing.
And now, the latest news and developments from Israel and the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, February 25th, 2009. A Palestinian teenager dies of wounds sustained last month in Gaza, and Palestinian internal dialogue starts. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian teenager from Gaza Strip was pronounced dead on Wednesday after he had sustained wounds during the recent Israeli war in the territory. Palestinian medical sources confirmed that Nabil Islim, age 17, died this morning in an Egyptian hospital where he was being treated for severe wounds. Sources reported that Islim was hit along with a number of others during an Israeli air attack against his house, where the Hamas interior minister Saeed Sayyam was assassinated in mid-January. With the death of Islim, the Gaza death toll as a result of the latest Israeli war has risen to 1,452, and the number of wounded now exceeds 6,000. At midday on Wednesday, Israeli military helicopters raided areas east of Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip. Palestinian sources stated that missiles hit open areas in Al-Salam and Al-Barazil neighborhoods in eastern Rafah city, causing damage but no injuries. Israeli military sources claim that their army targeted underground tunnels used to smuggle weapons into Gaza. Israeli army forces attacked a party that was held in the village of Al-Khadr near the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem late Tuesday night. The party was thrown for Zakaria Issa, age 29, who has just been released from an Israeli army detention camp after serving 7 years as a political detainee. Witnesses said that Israeli troops arrived to the party tent next to the Issa's family home, fired tear gas and sound bombs into the celebrations, and told the family to stop the party. The Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas stated on Wednesday that any future national unity government formed after an agreement between Fatah and Hamas must respect all past agreements signed by the Palestinian Liberation Organization. During a current visit to Norway, Abbas hoped that the factional negotiations, which began on Wednesday in the Egyptian capital Cairo, will push Hamas to recognize past signed agreements with Israel. President Abbas added that international recognition is necessary for any Palestinian government in order to deal with the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and the continued Israeli attacks in the West Bank. Thank you for joining us from Occupy Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today, from the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Ghassan Badnoura and George Ishmawi.
Human rights group Amnesty International has urged Guatemalan authorities to offer justice to the victims of its civil war. More than 200,000 people, mostly civilians, were killed or disappeared between 1960 and 1996. Amnesty says thousands of cases have not yet been dealt with by the country's Historical Clarification Commission. The group has asked the government to set up a national search commission for those who disappeared. Amnesty America says the Guatemalan authorities have the legal and moral duty to ensure that the crimes committed during the country's civil war are investigated. In addition, Amnesty wants to ensure that those responsible are brought to justice.
A top Kurdish politician has defied Turkish law by speaking his native language during a parliamentary address. Ahmet Türk was speaking to his party members in parliament when he suddenly switched from Turkish to Kurdish. Broadcasters immediately cut the address shown on live state television as Kurdish is banned in the Turkish parliament. But his party members gave him a standing ovation. About one-fifth of Turkey's population are ethnic Kurds, but speaking Kurdish in public was banned until the 1990s. It continues to be banned in all state institutions and official communication.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we are open to your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Brendan Grubb. Special thanks to reporters Robin Ryan, Sam Theobald, Avery Welkin, and Hayden Almiana. Our engineer is Brianna Loringer. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K26-4AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. I'm Nia Lewis.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge Talk Radio, the topic is Health Disparity and the County Budget Crisis, Testing for Anti-Black Bias. Guests include Tricia Tillman, manager of the Multnomah County Health Department's Health Equity Initiative. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, Anna Keith hosts Family Business. The topic is circumcision. At 10:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake interviews Jim Archer about his small portraits of faces at Life Gallery in the Everett Station Lofts. At 11, hear Air Cascadia news and commentary with Liam Delta and Chris Andre. And at 11:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. That's all right here on KBOO. Now, stay tuned for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News, and have a great evening.
From Pacifica Station, KPFK, in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, the 25th of February, 2009. President Obama names another choice for Commerce Secretary. We'll hear what that choice might mean for China-U.S. relations. Israel announces plans that could displace more than 1,000 Palestinians in Jerusalem. And we go to Connecticut, where residents pay some of the highest electricity rates in the nation. I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories after this news.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with today's headlines from Free Speech Radio News. In Afghanistan, violence continues to escalate. Three British troops were killed today from an explosion in the southern Helmand province. This follows a roadside bomb on Tuesday that killed four U.S. troops. 29 American troops have died in Afghanistan so far in 2009, compared with only 8 during the first 2 months of 2008. Meanwhile, after the announcement of the closure of the last U.S. base in Central Asia last week, Uzbekistan has agreed to allow NATO to send non-military supplies through the Central Asian nation en route to Afghanistan. Pakistan's opposition party, the Muslim League Nawaz, called for nationwide protests after the Supreme Court barred two of its leaders, including former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, from holding office. FSRN's Masroor Hussein reports from Islamabad.
Immediately following the court ruling, protesters came out on the streets. Hundreds of Muslim League supporters blocked roads and burned tires in Punjab cities. Shahbaz Sharif, the current chief minister of the country's richest Punjab province, was banned from standing for elections in 1998 when he was accused of involvement in the killing of 5 anti-government activists, but a court ruling acquitted him of the charges. Following today's court decision to uphold the 1998 charges, President Asif Zardari installed his own party's governor to take Shahbaz's place for the next 60 days, a move that some say is unconstitutional. Former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif was barred from participating in the 2008 elections. Today the court upheld his conviction of hijacking the then Army Chief General Pervez Musharraf's aircraft in 1999. Analysts believe political unrest in Pakistan will increase. The disqualified Sharif brothers have announced their party will take part in a nationwide sit-in on Thursday against President Zardari's government, whom they accused of towing the American line. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Masroor Hussain in Islamabad.
The Bangladeshi government has agreed to give immunity to border guards who opened fire inside their station today in the capital, Dhaka. Workers are angry about low pay and poor working conditions. They also took over a nearby shopping mall this morning. At least one person was killed in the crossfire between the guards and their supervisors. A standoff followed for several hours, with the guards demanding amnesty as well as increased pay, more food rations, and participation in high-paying U.S. peacekeeping missions. At least 20 people were injured in clashes between protesters and police in Indian-administered Kashmir today after the Indian Army killed 2 civilians. Shahnawaz Khan reports.
The 2 men were killed and another critically injured in the Bomai area near North Kashmir's Sopore town on Saturday evening. According to eyewitnesses, a team of Indian soldiers traveling in a vehicle resorted to unprovoked, indiscriminate firing. An Indian Army spokesman says the troops were chasing suspected militants and the 3 youth were shot in the crossfire. But locals disagree with that claim. Kashmiri separatists called for a shutdown of the entire valley. Banks and businesses were all closed in protest. Despite curfew-like restrictions, police still had to confront groups of people throwing stones. The local administration has ordered an inquiry into the incident and police have filed a case against the troops. But inquiries into military actions in the past have yielded few results, with troops enjoying impunity under special provisions like the Armed Forces Special Powers Act. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
At least 69 people have died in Somalia, where African Union peacekeepers and police are fighting several militias and the Islamist group Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab has also taken over a small town near the Ethiopian border. Groups wanting to impose Sharia law now control much of central and southern Somalia. A UN investigator has called for Kenya's police commissioner and attorney general to be removed, saying that Kenyan police kill often and with impunity. The UN report also called for Kenya's president to acknowledge the police misconduct and the need for reform, and for an independent police oversight commission to probe the killings. Additionally, the report called for a local tribunal and investigation by the International Criminal Court into the killing of more than 1,000 people following disputed elections in 2007. Florence Jacko, chairperson of the Kenyan National Commission on Human Rights, says there's evidence that the police and government officials helped instigate the violence.
There was organization and method to the violence. The attacks and counterattacks were carried out with military discipline.
This week, a video also emerged and was released to the public showing an officer saying he had been ordered by the police commissioner to kill suspects. Since giving the testimony, that officer has died of causes unknown. Doctors in Peru are on a 48-hour strike calling for pay increases which they say were promised to them by the government. The National Doctors Union called the strike after an unsuccessful meeting with the prime minister. The government claims that they have kept all promises made to the country's doctors. The average salary of a doctor in Lima is less than $700 a year, according to the Lancet Medical Journal, about one quarter of what it was in 1976. And today is the Tibetan New Year. Protests against Chinese oppression are taking place around the world. The Dalai Lama has called on Tibetans not to celebrate and warned them with the 50th anniversary of the failed uprising against Beijing next month, more oppression may follow. Tibet has already been closed to foreigners and media. March 10th marks 1 year since the Chinese began a heavy-handed crackdown on Tibetans and their demands for independence. Doctors in Peru are on a 48-hour strike calling for pay increases which they say were promised to them by the government. The National Doctors Union called the strike after an unsuccessful meeting with the prime minister. The government claims that they have kept all promises made to the country's doctors. The average salary of a doctor in Lima is less than $700 a year, according to the Lancet Medical Journal, about one quarter of what it was in 1976. And those are today's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
President Obama names another choice for Commerce Secretary. This time, it's Gary Locke. The former Washington State Governor is a Chinese-American with close ties to China. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell takes a look at how his role at Commerce might impact U.S.-China relations.
Gary Locke is Obama's third choice to be Commerce Secretary after the first two didn't work out. Governor Bill Richardson is under investigation, and Republican Senator Judd Gregg cited irreconcilable differences.
I'm sure it's not lost on anyone that we've tried this a couple of times, but I'm a big believer in keeping at something until you get it right. And Gary is the right man for this job.
Gary Locke is the former governor of Washington, the first Chinese American to hold any state's top position. He served two terms after a long career in public office. He's a Yale School graduate and grew up in public housing for immigrants during World War II.
The Department of Commerce can and will help create the jobs and the economic vitality our nation needs.
Locke has a close relationship with the Chinese government. President Hu Jintao visited Washington State in 2006 at Locke's urging. As the Commerce Secretary deals heavily in trade issues, he will have a leading role to play in the U.S.'s trade relationship with China, as the U.S. imports five times as much as it sends to China, contributing to a major trade imbalance. John Burbank is executive director of the Economic Opportunity Institute in Seattle. He says Washington became the country's biggest exporter during Locke's governorship.
What he did is sort of surveyed where we were strong, where we had strong industry, what products we were strong in, which was obvious what it was. It was Microsoft, it was airplanes, it was apples, it was wood products. And then he figured out how to open the doors to not just Chinese economy, but the Japanese economy, and particularly economies in Asia, to our exports.
Burbank says Locke's close relationship with the Chinese government would not be a hindrance, but beneficial.
It will enable him to be perhaps more hard-nosed with China in terms of things like the value of their currency and in terms of trying to get labor and environmental standards put in place. And I think that it'll be good because, you know, sometimes it's good to have a friend who sort of is able to up the ante.
Locke must be confirmed by the Senate. Republicans are expected to inquire about his views on the census. Obama has indicated he wants the census directors to report to the White House in addition to the Commerce Secretary. Republicans call it a political move as the census data is used to determine congressional districts and federal funding. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
In his first address before a joint session of Congress last night, President Obama offered a tone of optimism despite difficult economic times. He said the government must play a role in economic recovery via the stimulus, housing assistance, and backing Wall Street. He hearkened back to the way government has historically helped create and maintain a middle class.
In each case, government didn't supplant private enterprise. It catalyzed private enterprise. It created the conditions for thousands of entrepreneurs and new businesses to adapt and to thrive. We are a nation that has seen promise amid peril and claimed opportunity from ordeal. Now we must be that nation again.
Obama set forth his priorities for his administration, which he calls his vision: energy, health care reform, and education. The president says he will double renewable energy production in 3 years, reform health care, and make it financially easier to get a higher education. He also addressed the Iraq War.
I am committed to restoring a sense of honesty and accountability to our budget. That is why this budget looks ahead 10 years. And accounts for spending that was left out under the old rules. And for the first time, that includes the full cost of fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. For 7 years, we've been a nation at war. No longer will we hide its price.
Details of Obama's priorities will become more evident tomorrow when he releases his 2010 budget blueprint. A U.S. Navy admiral charged with determining whether current conditions at the Guantanamo Bay detention facility comply with applicable law says conditions there are humane. Admiral Patrick Walsh told reporters the U.S. is treating detainees at Guantanamo appropriately.
After considerable deliberation and a comprehensive review, it is our judgment that the conditions of confinement in Guantanamo are in conformity with Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions.
Common Article 3 applies to the treatment of soldiers in detention. Admiral Walsh added that after a 13-day review, his team found that personnel at Guantanamo are using no illegal actions.
Any substantiated evidence of prohibited acts discovered in the course of the review would have warranted a finding of noncompliance with Common Article 3. We found no such evidence.
But not everyone agrees with the report's findings. Some Guantanamo detainees are still held in solitary confinement, and others are still force-fed. Shane Cotterdall is managing attorney of the Guantanamo Project at the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Two-thirds of the detainees, they're in solitary confinement prisons. They're in supermax prisons where they basically, you know, spend 20 hours a day in their cells. Have very, very limited opportunity to pray collectively, no opportunity to have meals collectively, very limited opportunity to have recreation time collectively, and that's something new that they introduced in the last 2 months. The other big, big issue besides solitary confinement is force feeding. A lot of detainees, you know, when they're faced with having total uncertainty about when they'll ever get out, you know, no trial or charging process for accusing them of anything, and just this complete, you know, sense that they have no idea when, you know what will happen to them. They take control of the one thing they can do, which is they stop eating. And this has happened in prisons, you know, everywhere in the world. And the force feeding regime at Guantanamo has been particularly brutal. It's been designed to be, you know, very physically rough on the detainees in order to convince them to stop their hunger strikes. And so the protocols around that are another big area where I think we're very far away from compliance with applicable law.
Cotterdall says his group is recommending solitary confinement at Guantanamo be ended and that revisions be made to the facility's force-feeding protocols.
Prisoners who are mentally capable of making an informed decision to stop eating should be allowed to stop eating, and they shouldn't be force-fed until at least that point in which they've lost the mental capacity to make, you know, sort of free will's decision about that. And they certainly shouldn't be fed in the sort of restraint chair environment that we see down there where they're strapped in for an hour before they're force-fed, then force-fed for an hour while they're strapped with multiple point restraints to this restraint chair and then kept there for an hour and a half so that they can't throw up what they've just been force-fed. That and the physical brutality accompanying their drag to the location to be force-fed, that all has to stop.
Shane Cotterdall is managing attorney of the Guantanamo Project at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Although not internationally recognized, Israel maintains that the entire city of Jerusalem is its capital. Israeli plans to build a park in East Jerusalem would mean that more than 1,000 Palestinians would be displaced, and residents there are preparing for the worst. FSRN's Hassan Banoura reports.
The latest Israeli demolition plan will displace some 1,400 Palestinians, announced by the Israeli media just 3 days ago, The plan is to evacuate 88 homes in the Al-Bustan neighborhood located immediately south of Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem Old City. Some of those homes were built before 1967. Israel's blueprint for this long-term Palestinian neighborhood is a park with flowers, trees and cafes, according to the Israeli municipality of Jerusalem. Khalil Al-Tafakji, the head of the MAPS department at the Orient House in Jerusalem, says this is not a new plan.
This new Israeli policy is actually old. It's about to control the demographics of Jerusalem and implement the 2020 Jerusalem Project to minimize Palestinian residents of Jerusalem in the name of the Holy Historical Project of Israel.
The municipality of Jerusalem says this area is an important cultural and historical site for the Jewish nation because it stands on the site where King David established his kingdom. This is not the first such order. In 2005, the Israeli government issued demolition orders for all of the homes on the grounds of no licensing. Since then, local NGOs and owners, along with a team of engineers, worked to meet all the Israeli requirements and planning laws, yet they were still denied by Israel. Hassan Al-Qadi, an owner of a home in Al-Bustan, explains.
My house has two floors and was built around 150 years ago. A while ago, we had a meeting with the Israeli Interior Ministry. They told us they were denying us building permits. A few days later, the municipality planners, along with police, came and took photos and measurements of some houses. Since then, we have had our protest tent here.
Since Israel occupied the city of Jerusalem in 1967, the authorities have rarely given Palestinian residents permission to build homes. The Israeli government has continued to build Jewish settlements in and around Jerusalem, which is illegal under international law. Legal avenues have so far failed to protect Palestinian residents. If this plan goes through, local activists say that this could be the largest displacement of Palestinians by Israel since the 67 war. For FSRN and IMEMC.org, this is Ghassan Badnoura.
The role of water in economic development is widely recognized, but lack of information relating to its quality and quantity sometimes hampers its use. This is particularly true for groundwater, which is usually out of sight. The Republic of Namibia, part of the driest region in sub-Saharan Africa, wants to know more about its hidden resources. As Moses Magadza reports, the Namibian government began the country's first groundwater quantification project this month.
Kenneth Kapeng is 26 years old and works as a chef in the outskirts of the Namibian capital, Windhoek. But his heart is not in the city. Kenneth grew up in his family's farm in Gobabis, 200 miles from here, and never wanted to migrate to the city for a job.
Our family has a farm in Gobabis on the way to Botswana, about 70 kilos out of Gobabis. We have about 30 cattle on the farm. We can keep hundreds, actually, but the problem is that the water is a little.
The water in Kapeng's family farm was not enough to sustain commercial livestock production, and he had to move to Windhoek City in search of greener pastures with a job that does not pay much. He says if water could be found in his farm, he would be out of town in a flash. Kenneth is among the many Namibians who want to know if there is water underground in their farms, and if it does, in what quantity and quality. In 2001, Namibia produced a hydrogeological map with funding from Germany. The map showed that Namibia was the driest country in sub-Saharan Africa. In some places, the water table was several hundreds of meters below the surface. That shocked everyone. And now, after the map, Namibia is going a step further. The government is doing groundwater quantification. Greg Christelis is the deputy director in the Department of Water Affairs and Forestry.
Now that we have this hydrogeological map of Namibia, which indicates that 43% of Namibia has a reasonable to good groundwater potential, the next step is to actually take this information and turn it into figures and quantify the amounts for further development, for industry, for settlement purposes, for creating infrastructure.
Dr. Benjamin Mapani teaches geology at the University of Namibia. He is associated with the quantification project.
I think it's not only necessary, but overdue, because Namibia depends on groundwater for almost two-thirds of the surface area of the country. And therefore, we need this project to actually tell us how much water there is, and how old is that water, and at what rate we are taking it out of the ground, because in most cases it may not be a renewable resource. Groundwater is the largest resource of fresh water in the world, so it must be looked after well, protected from pollution, and also managed sustainably.
For the next 4 years, Dr. Mapani and his team plan to study the rock types to find out which aquifers have high yielding potential and which don't. At the end of the program, they hope to know how much water could potentially be extracted. Namibia becomes the third country in the Southern African Development Community after Botswana and South Africa to undertake such a project. Expectations are that the study will generate water availability data which will influence the national planning policies. Namibia is also busy with land reforms, and this data could enable the country to resettle its people more intelligently. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Moses Magaza reporting from Windhoek.
As we continue our series on energy around the globe, today we're going to Connecticut, one of 12 states that have deregulated their energy markets. Residents here pay some of the highest electricity rates in the continental U.S. A grassroots group recently helped defeat a request by a local utility to increase rates, and activists are now pushing for rate reduction and to re-regulate the sector. As Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven, it's been an uphill battle.
New Havener Paula Panzarella and her husband were so outraged by United Illuminating Company's request in late 2006 to pass through a 50% increase in charges that they helped organize Fight the Hike.
We were sitting at a potluck dinner with a number of friends who said we got to do something.
They took busloads of consumers to the Capitol in Hartford, where they rallied, testified before lawmakers, and submitted legislation to re-regulate the industry. Despite their best efforts, the state's Department of Public Utility Control, or DPUC, approved the whopping increase, which raised some consumers' bills over $100 a month. The agency also approved a similar increase over a longer time period for the state's other electricity company, Connecticut Light and Power. Since deregulation in 1998, UI and CLNP only distribute electricity and bill customers, but no longer generate it. They are still regulated by the state, and profits are limited to less than 10% return on investment. But there is no control on suppliers' profits, which have risen dramatically along with the cost of energy. Those two factors led UI and CLNP to request permission to pass the increase along to customers. 2 years later, UI was back asking for another big increase, this time for investment in infrastructure, as well as increased compensation for some of its own top executives. The head of UI already makes almost $2 million a year. Panzarella says Fight the Hike swung into action against the increase.
This one in particular was pretty brutal to people because they said they wanted it to make up for the loss in sales because people are conserving electricity. Now, we're supposed to conserve. We're supposed to save. And here, because we're conserving to lower our bills, UI is saying they want to have a higher rate to make up the difference.
This time they had better luck. Earlier this month, the DPUC turned down UI's request, saying another increase was not warranted. Panzarella was pleased, though she sees it as one battle in a bigger war.
We certainly do feel it was a big victory that the DPUC heard people and realized that we're hurting all over the state from the exorbitant electric rates.
Fight the Hike would like to see the state re-regulate the industry, and they've convinced municipal governments and several towns around the state to pass resolutions calling for just that. The group is also pushing the creation of a Connecticut Energy Authority, which would authorize the state to buy electricity and set the selling price to customers. Tyson Slocum, director of Public Citizens Energy Program, looks at the issue from a national perspective. He points out that when a state deregulates, it voluntarily cedes jurisdiction over wholesale electricity markets to the federal government, namely the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. He says that rather than focus on state officials,
the better solution would be legislation mandating that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission start regulating all of these companies in Connecticut and elsewhere that are under their jurisdiction. They currently do not regulate. Re-regulation means allowing the companies to charge rates directly tied to their costs, not tied to whatever profit margin they want to achieve.
Meanwhile, Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal is fighting on both the state and federal levels, where he's filed a number of lawsuits against FERC.
Deregulation has been a disaster, and we need to take back control by reforms at the state level.
So, like Fight the Hike, he's in favor of creating a state energy authority to eliminate what he calls excessive profits of up to 100% of return on investment, compared to 10% return under state regulation. He's also advocated a windfall profits refund to return to consumers a part of the high profits power generators have made under deregulation.
Windfall profits are a result of both state deregulation and very misguided and disastrous federal energy policies that presume a free market where none exists.
But Blumenthal is hopeful about the future.
My hope is that there will be a change in federal policy with a new administration that recognizes the disastrous effect of windfall profits and excessive compensation for utilities and their executives.
For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
And you can hear more from our Global Energy Series running on EMPTY on our website, fsrn.org. And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback by dropping us an email to comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and today's headlines editor is Andrew Stelzer. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Puck Lowe and Rose Katapchi. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. To KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM Portland. Stay tuned for the underground. Thursday, February 26th from 8 to 10 p.m. Guess Who's Coming to Radio is honoring the 50th anniversary of Motown Records. We're going to dig into the crates of the label once touted as the sound of young America. And we will also look at the complex histories, the successes, and the struggles. We will air some on-the-street responses from people who answered what Motown means to them. And of course, we're going to do what Motown gave us, and that's music. Call in that night or beforehand, leave questions or comments at www.kboo.fm/guesswho'scomingtoradio. So listen up on Thursday, February 26th at 8 p.m. Guess Who's Coming to Radio on KBOO.
I'm sure you don't remember me. And now it's been 10 years. I'm still wondering who to be. And I'd love to mix in circles, cliques, and social coteries. That's me.
Hand me my nose.
Make me be happy. Show me the mosh pit.
All right, welcome to the Underground, the KBU's public affairs show. This month, our theme is the Great Northwest. Now, depending on who you ask, everyone has a different definition of the Great Northwest, the Pacific Northwest. But the one that I found most prevalent on the mighty internet is that the Pacific Northwest includes Alaska, Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Washington. So we'll be discussing and listening to some pieces about things happening in Alaska, Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Washington. We're going to start this evening with a piece done by a person from NAYA, which is the Native American Youth Association here in Portland. And tonight, we're going to hear from Jolynn Big Medicine, who is interviewing Chelsea Rowland.
All right, my name's Jolynn. I go to school at NAYA. I'm 14. Today I'm interviewing my sister. Chelsea, you can introduce yourself.
My name is Chelsea LaForge. I'm from Montana. I'm 31 years old. I'm married, and I have two kids. And I work at the legal department for the Crow Tribe. That's about all.
Where is the Crow Reservation?
It's one of the federally recognized tribes in the state of Montana. It is the largest, I think, reservation in the state, and it's in the southeast corner, and it borders the Northern Cheyenne Reservation.
Are there any events that happen at Crow?
Like traditional events?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, we have a Crow Fair every year. We also have a dance to celebrate Christmas and the New Year. And there's various other powwows for 4th of July and whatever community decides to have a powwow. Mm-hmm. Then they also have lots of clan feeds. And there's several clans in the Crow tribe. And whenever you want to ask for prayers, or anything that you're doing, like for surgery or, you know, even for a basketball tournament, then you ask your clan fathers to pray for you, and then they'll get together and you give them things. You usually give them four things, like a blanket, tobacco, material, and money. That's what we usually give them, and then they offer up prayers for you. And it's like an exchange where you, if you want, like, really good prayers, then you give them really good gifts, you know, so...
What's your favorite part of being on the reservation?
My favorite part right now is being close to my family, because I'm really close to my mom and my sister, and I really enjoy the fact that I can see them every day, and I can really count on them for anything, and I don't have to pay them for babysitting.
Have you ever
been... If I'm off the reservation, I can't do that. I have to pay, like, $25 a day.
I was about to ask you that question, too, if you've ever been off.
Oh, yep. I didn't grow up in around here. I grew up in Bozeman, and I was the only Indian kid for a long time. And then when I was in fifth grade, there was this Indian girl that came, and that was really awesome.
What's the difference between being off the res and being on the Crow Reservation?
Well, it depends. When I was growing up in Bozeman, that felt normal to me. It didn't feel any different. And when I came to the res, it was a whole different story, because everybody here knows everything about everything. And when you're off the reservation, it's not really like that. You have, like, your little group of friends and people you hang out with when you're off the reservation. And, of course, they all pretty much know what's going on. But here it's different. You know, you're probably related to the store clerk and... the janitor at the hospital, you know, as much as you're related to somebody who works at the administration building at the tribe, and they kind of keep a sort of control here because you don't want to embarrass your family, you know, so you don't really behave too, you don't really do things that you wouldn't do. Whereas when you're off the reservation, you're a little more adventurous and you kind of want to do things just because you want to do things, and you're not really, well, for me, I'm not really conscious about, you know, who's watching me or what they're going to say, or because, like, in the Crow way, there's just different things. Like, you don't wear, like, for example, little bitty shorties around your uncles because it's a form of respect. You know, you respect your uncles, you respect your brothers, so you don't dress inappropriately. Whereas if I'm off the reservation, not that I wear Daisy Dukes because I'm 31 years old, but when I was younger, that's something that I enjoyed. I enjoyed the freedom of wearing whatever I wanted. Does that make sense?
What is your role in Crow society as a traditional Crow woman and a modern-day Crow woman?
I feel like my role and kind of my goal in life is to be a positive role model and to show, like, especially little girls, that they are capable of doing anything. I'm taking a year off of school right now. I want to be a lawyer. I always wanted to be a lawyer, and right now I got into law school, and I just had a baby, and I already see, you know, younger girls and girls in high school asking me how I did it, how I got through college, how I got my degree, how I did it by myself, and it takes a lot of support, and it takes a lot of confidence and independence and responsibility, and I can't believe that I did that. So I think it would be even more awesome to have my my law degree so that more girls out there can feel empowered, so I can help the younger generation of women feel empowered. Mm-hmm. So I think that's my role.
Do Crows have their own medicine?
Yeah, they have, I don't know extensively what kinds they have, but there's all different kinds. My grandpa was a medicine man, and when I was growing up, I saw him use a lot of it, and I believe in it because I think that it worked. I think a lot of stuff that he did was working, and I have a lot of respect for that. My grandma was also, she was Catholic. She was a very devout Catholic, and they lived together peacefully. You know, I never heard them argue about it. They both respected each other's religion, so I know it's there, and my grandpa passed on some of his medicine to my little brother so he can smudge the house, like he'll pray for the house with his cedar. And all I know about that is each medicine man has their spirit helpers, and they don't like the smell of humans. So, and especially like the Crow will go as far as they'll clean a house and they'll put anything like that might have body odors, like shoes and stuff, they'll put that all in one spot so that the spirit helpers will feel more comfortable when they come to your house, too, mm-hmm. like when you're praying. So, like, when my brother prays for the house, we'll clean up and make sure that the house smells extra good, and put all the shoes and stuff away and clean the bathrooms so they're not stinky.
Mm-hmm. what can you use cedar for?
Well, like other tribes, I know other tribes will use cedar at any time when they want to pray, kind of like, I don't know, using a crucifix or, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's more general, but I know the Crow are a little more traditional, and so you have to have that rite passed on to you. And it's generally used for prayers. So, like whenever you're praying about something, for the same reason that you might go to your clan uncles or your clan aunts to pray for you, you would use the cedar. Like, I don't have the right to use it, so I don't feel right praying with it. So I'll ask my brother if there's something that I need to be praying about. Like, you know, for example, if I saw something at the house, mm-hmm. which is not unreasonable because we're always seeing things out there. Mm-hmm. But if it freaked me out, I'd call up Frank and say, you know, come over and can you pray for the house? And then we'll clean up and he'll pray for the house. And that's usually how we use cedar. The Crow people, anyway.
Is there anything else you wanted to add that I haven't asked?
That I'm 5'7" and 125 pounds, and I'm a total bombshell. I'm kidding.
This is Jolene for the KWU Youth Collective.
Okay, for more information, Jolene will be back next month with other kids from NAIA. Thank you.
This month's topic is the Great Northwest. I'm interviewing the local artist Mark Larson about his role in the upcoming Southeast Area Art Walk. One of the first things I think of when I think of the Northwest is art, and anyone knows why if they've been to any of these places or events. Art Walk, Buckman Art Show, the Tacoma Glass Museum, Portland Art Museum, First Friday, or others. Tell us about yourself.
Well, good morning, Sawyer. I'm living here in Portland. I'm an artist, and I am excited about the Art Walk because it gives me a chance to sell some of my art. I have been in Portland for about 15, well, altogether maybe about 20 years, 25 years now, although half a dozen of those years I was in L.A. teaching kids your age art and doing other things. I was born in Oregon, in a small town, Lebanon, Oregon, but was raised in the military all over the world, and China and Japan and Hawaii and East Coast and West Coast. And in all those places I lived, I saw beautiful things, and I was interested in drawing and painting, and I've always done that ever since I was little.
Hmm. Well, tell us about your art.
Well, right now I'm concentrating on painting, although I've done lots of other kinds of things. I've done sculpture. I've done, as you know, mask making, because you're working on a mask that I helped your mom make, and or she helped me make. And I've done a lot of building, like theater set designs, that kinds of things. But right now, continuing with trying to become a better painter. And that is kind of a lifelong project.
When and where can we see your art?
Well, you can see my art at Brad Rogers Gallery on Broadway. And I also have a little space on Division that is not much more than a Saturday market booth where I have hung my art. It's right around the corner from where I live here. It's on Division at 3542 Division. And I have a bunch of paintings there. A lot of them are what is kind of left over from other shows that I've had. And so I have them up there for people to see and for people to buy. Also, I'm making prints and cards so people can buy copies of my art.
Hmm. Tell us about the Southeast Area Art Walk.
Well, this has been going on for several years. I have this neighbor you might be acquainted with, Rin Carol Jackson. She had the idea that there were a lot of artists in the area and in the immediate area of Southeast Portland, the inner Southeast, and that we should all get together and show our art some spring. And we did that, and we've done it every spring for the last 6 years.
What caused you to join the Southeast Area Art Walk?
Well, it just seemed like a good idea. It's a good way for lots of people to see my art. I've had hundreds and hundreds of people come by my house when I was showing art in my house here. There could be, like, oh, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of people come by. So that's great. I get to meet a lot of people. I get to sell some art. And people get to see not just my art, but hundreds of other artists on the same weekend.
What are you doing for the Art Walk?
Right now, I'm painting. As you can see, we have the recorder propped up against some beautiful orange and red peppers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've been painting them. And if you look around the kitchen here, you see the oranges and the bananas and the pears and the avocados. I will paint them unless they go rotten. I've been on a race here to try to paint as fast as I can to get some stuff done. Right now I have some lemons that I'm painting.
Hmm. What's your favorite thing about the art walk?
My favorite thing about the art walk is one of my favorite things has been after it's all over, I'll get a card or a letter from someone and they'll tell me how much they love their painting that they got from me.
Hmm. What's your job in the art walk exactly?
My job? Well, I have been on the council to help try to plan and organize it. And so that's kind of a job.
Well, what's your favorite thing about what you do?
My favorite thing about what I do, mm-hmm. as far as painting goes?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Painting is not always easy. It's not always fun. And it's not always satisfactory. I have many paintings that I have trouble with when I'm in the middle of them. They seem like they're a mess. And then I try to pull them out of that mess and make them look halfway decent. When it's all done and the painting seems to work, then I feel great satisfaction. And it gives me encouragement to continue to try to do more and be better. I have certain heroes in painting that have been what you would call a master. And although that's not what I would call myself, I can still aspire to be better. And that's part of what art is all about. There's no top. You can go as far as you can go, and then you can go farther. And that's part of what the incentive is. Just keep at it. Keep doing it, and keep getting better.
Well, what's the first thing you think of when you think of the Northwest?
When I think of the Northwest?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've lived, as I said, lots of different places. I lived in China, I lived in Hawaii, I lived in Japan, I lived in Rhode Island and Virginia, I lived in Arizona and New Mexico and Southern California. And when I think of the Northwest, I really do think of it being green, and having trees that are plentiful, mountains, rivers, clouds, rain. I think of it as home. All the animals, a lot of the animals we have are somewhere else, that live other places in the world, but it seems to all come together in the Northwest in a nice, moist, green, healthy, hopefully, sustainable environment.
Hmm.
It seems like home.
Thanks for talking with me. This is Sawyer Jackson from the Cable Youth Collective.
Okay, the Art Walk is February 28th to March 1st, and the website is www.se, for Southeast, portlandartwalk.com. Thank you. Okay. Hello, this is Zoe and Contrita with the KBOO Youth Collective. As you know, the theme for this month's show is the Great Northwest. Contrita and I have done a little research about movies that have been based on or filmed in the Northwest. Take it away, Katrina.
Gee willikers, there sure is a lot of movies that have been based on or filmed in the Northwest. Some are well known, while others might never have heard of.
Really? Hmm.
You've probably heard of The Shining, The Goonies, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and of course Twilight. But you probably didn't know that Free Willy, Untraceable, and The Ring were filmed here as well.
Oh, wow. I did not know that all those movies were filmed right here in the Northwest. Can you tell our listeners a little more about some of the movies made right here?
Sure thing. There's The Goonies, which is a very famous children's movie made in the 80s about two brothers, Mikey and Brandon Walsh, whose family is getting ready to move so that developers can build a golf course on their land.
Oh, no.
A band of kids from the Goondocks neighborhood of Astoria, Oregon, hoping to save their homes from demolition, go on an adventure to find the buried treasure of One-Eyed Willie, a legendary 17th century pirate. They head to the north... the coast, and stumble upon an abandoned seaside restaurant that seems to match coordinates to the map and an old doubloon. With the help of Mouth, an annoying but loyal friend of the group, they are able to translate the map and confirm they are headed in the right direction. But what the Goonies don't know is that the restaurant is actually a secret hideout of a family of Italian criminals. Once Brandon finally tracks down the boys and insists they return home immediately, they are met with Steph and Andy, two female peers Brandon knew from school. With treasure to find and with Brad being distracted by the company of girls, Mikey continues to search for clues, feeling that he is closer than ever in finding the treasure.
Aww.
Again, this was filmed in Astoria, Oregon.
That is pretty cool. I've never watched The Goonies, but now that I know that they're, like, filmed right here, I have to rent it sometime. How about you tell us a little bit about Twilight? That is a big thing right now. I've read the book and watched the movie, and a lot of the scenery I recognize, including the top of my house and the tree shot. But can you tell us a little more about what Twilight is and where it was filmed exactly?
Sure. It is a very good book. I've read it myself. You have too. It is a vampire romance between Bella Swan and Edward Cullen. Edward is a vampire, by the way. Even though they come from different worlds, they are drawn together, bloodthirsty and all. Scenes are filmed mostly in Portland, Oregon. Instead of shooting at Forks High School itself, scenes taking place at the school were filmed at Kalama High School and Madison High School. Other scenes were also filmed in St. Helens, Oregon. They also did some reshooting in Pasadena, California in August.
Mm.
There were also a couple of other places through the gorge that the film was shot in. The studio intended to create a series of at least three films based on Meyer's books, and Summit had optioned New Moon by October 2008. Twilight was originally scheduled to be theatrically released in the United States on December 12, 2008, but its release date was changed to November 21st.
Wow, that is really cool. Thanks for sharing that information, Katrina. Thanks for listening with the Cable Youth Collective, The Underground. This is Zoe.
And Katrina.
Signing off.
Could you guys go ahead and introduce yourselves and just say a little bit about who you are and why you're here today?
Well, my name is Leah Cantwell. I'm a student at Leap High, and I'm a sophomore, and I've been at Leap High for 2 years.
My name is Sean Forrest Hadley, and I am a sophomore. I've been at Leap High for 2 weeks.
What exactly is Leap High School?
Leap High School is a leadership and entrepreneurship high school geared towards teaching leadership and entrepreneurship.
Unlike most schools, we learn via actual being involved in our school, and so we get to do leadership at a practical level.
It's also cool because we use technology and laptops and overhead projectors and frequently watch educational movies in class, so it's not a lecture style. It's more of a group work, project-based learning.
Now that it's our third year, we are in the middle of a charter renewal process, and so it's all dependent on next week whether we even exist tomorrow.
Would you say that is affecting the livelihood of your school at all?
I would say that we are doing everything we possibly can to put our best foot forward and be all that we can be as Leap High students. Our numbers are pretty impressive. One of the concerns is that is our funding, because we are having a little bit of a funding crisis as I speak. So we created a board of people, students and parents and faculty, that come and fundraise. I'm a part of the fundraising committee. So at this point, if we can show that we actually can raise $40,000 by June 1st and $40,000 next year, and to compensate for our teachers that took a 10% pay cut as well, we can be in existence. So that seems to be one of the major concerns of those in the committee that decide if our school can run next year.
I think that the fact that we are being involved really hit a good spot when we were talking to the board the other day. They were really seemed to be like, yeah, this is good. So we have a really high chance of surviving.
In our leadership class, we actually are creating a marketing campaign for LEAP, and each group of 3 to 6 students are going to go out and advertise for LEAP High. I'm going to have a pie eating contest at Madison Skate Park. So students are really taking on the personal responsibility and living up to all that LEAP is, which is leadership.
So you mentioned the pie eating contest. What other kind of fundraising plans are in the works?
Well, I'm a part of the fundraising committee, and Sean was at the meeting as well. So I know that we are hoping to have a benefit concert, T-shirt, pens, pencils, flyers have gone out. People are recruiting more students and getting them to come to school. Videos are being made. We are trying to revamp our website, and students are doing that as well. I'm not familiar with each and every project, but I do know there are some that are in the works. Also, we are thinking of having a camp for kids in 8th grade to 9th grade to teach leadership and entrepreneurship in the summer, and also just to know what LEAP's about.
So what can our listeners do to help?
Talk to your friends about LEAP. I mean, we're in our third year running, so go to leaphigh.org. If you call LEAP High, the front office, which is 503-254-2537, you can ask questions if you want to come and visit our school. We're on 20th and Burnside. Come talk to our teachers. Come and talk to our students. Really just going to the website and coming in the school, you'll get a feel for how we are. There's not a special day that is only for visitors and students. So the day that you come, that's who we are and that's what we're about, and any day is fine.
Yeah, the good thing about LEAP is that unlike other schools which have this huge bureaucracy and you got to do this and you got to do that, you got to sign all these forms, for the most part there isn't all that much paperwork. All you do is show up and they will let you come to school. It's not like they'll kick you out just for showing up. And they are always positive. They're always willing to help you be involved in any way possible.
If you have a business and you'd like an intern, you can always contact LEAP and have an intern come. Really, the website and calling the school or coming to the school would be the best options.
Awesome. And is there anything that you guys wanted to add?
If I couldn't go to LEAP High School, I don't know where I would personally go. From my learning style and from all the schools I've been to, 7, this has been the best one for me so far. I feel like I'm smart and I feel like I can succeed when my teachers stay until 7 o'clock to help me on a math paper so that I can get it done and get a good grade. I really know that I'm in the right place. So if anyone isn't feeling like they are getting what they need at their school and the help isn't enough for them, or they like something new, I would definitely check out LEAP High.
People come from all over Portland to come to LEAP. We have like 11 different sections that people come from just to come to LEAP. It's a great school. Everybody who's come through has had been spoken highly of it. There are a few people that have left, but it's not best for everybody. If you like debate, you'll love the English class here.
And we are community-based and small school, so I know everyone at the school. They know what's going on in my life. It's friendly. There are no cliques. Everyone's friends with everyone because we're so different that we can't possibly even create a clique. So it's really just, it's a community-based school. It's a high school where if you come, you have to work very hard to fail.
Thank you very much for being here today. And again, if anyone wants to help out or learn more about LEAP High School, you can visit their website at leaphigh.org. That's leaphigh.org. Or you can call the school at 503-254-2537. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Katrina, and I'm interviewing people with the Music with Reason class at Centennial Learning Center. We'll go around the table, and could you each tell us your name and how old you are?
Hi, my name is Alex, and I'm 18.
Hi, I'm Laura, and I'm 15.
Hi, I'm Tyler. I'm their teacher, and I'm not telling you how old I am.
Okay, tell us about your school, Tyler.
Well, Centennial Learning Center is an alternative middle and high school in the Centennial School District in East County. We have about 150 or so students in the several different types of programs. We cater to people who want to go to school in a smaller environment with smaller classes, more individual attention, more opportunity to kind of pursue things that, I don't know, that your people are individually interested in, sort of like this class that we're going to talk about here tonight.
That's cool. How did this class start?
About a year ago, a guy named Chris, who doesn't work at our school anymore, but he was a counselor previously. He had written a grant, I'll spare you the details, but basically we got some money to get a bunch of equipment and some training on this music software program called Reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had some folks from Old Library Studio, which is a nonprofit that sort of caters to youth music in town. Mm-hmm. They came out and taught us teachers and a group of students how to use this program and sort of got us off and running. So now we have enough training with it and we have the equipment. Mm-hmm. And so now we can sort of do this class over and over again with different groups of kids that want to learn how to make their own tunes.
Mm-hmm. Now, Laura, what music style do you produce?
Well, I just produce all kinds of music and what types of music I like, and yeah.
Cool. Why did you sign up for this class, Alex?
Well, the reason I signed up for this class was because it gave me a chance to basically show how I feel about my music, like put my emotion into it,
mm-hmm.
and just prove that I can do something, and my parents probably wouldn't get mad at me, so.
Now, can you tell us about how you put songs together?
Okay, how I, well.
All of you. Oh, you can too answer.
Laura, you want to explain sort of just how the program works, just in general?
Well, how it works in general is just like, you have like these samples that comes with the program, and you can like put your samples into a little like,
yeah, like a sequencer. You build songs out of all the different sounds that you can use.
You can also import other samples into it.
So essentially, you have tons of devices and thousands, literally thousands of sounds that you can mess around with and adjust and make whatever you want. Then you find things that you like, and then you piece them together into different parts, and then you make songs. So you can sort of create your own beats, or we have keyboards where you can play your own parts.
Mm-hmm.
You can really make any, basically you can make any kind of sound that you want or any kind of song that you want.
That sounds amazing.
It's really cool.
Hard to comprehend how many songs you could make.
There's no limit, I don't think.
Different kinds. Now, what else does your class do?
Well, we also, like for what we're doing like right now,
mm-hmm.
well, the people who've been there for a while are making a 7-track album.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing like album art and making our own band. Well, some people are. And for the people who just started are basically getting help from the teachers and learning about the program.
Uh-huh. And what's the hardest thing you've had to learn so far?
The hardest thing I've had to learn is probably putting recordings like that with my voice or someone else's voice into the track.
Uh-huh. And what's the goal of the class, Laura?
Well, I think the goal of the class is to, like, really try something new and just try to, like, get your feelings out by the music and just enjoy yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And is there anything else you want to add? Like about info about the class or?
Well,
could you give us a website or a phone number?
Well, yeah, the school's phone number is 503-762-3202. And honestly, I can't remember the organization that gave us the grant or that we got the grant through.
Uh-huh.
But if you wanted to contact the CLC, Centennial Learning Center, and you are a teacher out there, I'm sure I could find you that information because I would recommend what we're doing to anybody. It's just so such a cool thing.
And how can they reach you?
Well, they can call us. You can go to the Centennial School District website, and it has a link to our CLC school's website.
And what's the what?
I don't know what the exact. It's long. It's like it connects through the centennial.k12.or.us mm-hmm. is the Centennial School District website.
Okay, thanks for coming into KBU. That was a great interview.
Yeah.
So, cut to other stuff.
And now we're going to play one of their songs, so please tune in.
And that was your song, Laura?
Yeah.
All right, so we just heard Laura's song, correct?
Yep.
And so you made that in your class at Centennial?
Yeah.
Using the Reason program?
Yep.
So what was your favorite thing about making that piece?
I think, I don't know if it was, like, if anyone was able to hear it, but there's, like, a heartbeat at the beginning, and so I think, like, that's why I named it Listen to Your Heart, because it's, like, your heart has so many emotions that you should listen to it.
That's awesome. And are all those, like, the heart sound, et cetera, are the, all those, like, pre-programmed onto the Reason program? Or are those things that you have to, like, find and download?
Oh, it all comes with the Reason program.
That's awesome. So is that your first piece that you've made, or have you made other pieces before?
I have made other pieces.
Do you think that's your favorite piece so far, or how do you feel about it?
Well, I don't really have a favorite piece because, like, well, they're all my favorites because they're, like, I was trying to, like, express how, like, I feel and what my emotions are and, like, what I believe in. And I just try to put it inside all my music.
That's awesome. So next we're going to listen to another song from another student in your class at Centennial. Are you ready, Billy?
Yeah.
Thanks.
And here's the first song.
Uh-huh.
Okay, can you tell us who did that piece?
That song was written by a student named Devin, who was in our class last semester. She wasn't able to come with us today, but I put it on the disc because I just wanted to, I don't know, because I liked it, and I wanted to sort of demonstrate a little bit of variety in terms of the sorts of songs that you people have come up with and that you can come up with using the,
cool.
The program.
If she was here, did you, like, what did she think about this piece?
She really liked it, and that was actually the first song that she had made. And the cool part was is that you heard the beats in there that she actually played those beats herself. Like, they weren't programmed in. She had to, you know, count and play the actual drums, like,
yeah.
On the keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And then the keyboard parts, and she has never played the piano or anything, so... That's actually another kind of cool thing about this is, like, we've got a kid in the class now who's, like, he's all about learning how to play the piano. And, I mean, that wasn't the intent, but
yeah. He's
teaching himself how to play the piano, basically, by making songs on this program, which is, it's just really cool.
Cool. Well, I think the next song we're going to be playing is by Alex, who's here with us now. So, is there anything you'd like to say about the song before it starts?
Yeah, actually there is. I put a lot of emotion into this song, as in, like, my heart and soul, so I hope you all enjoy it.
Okay, well, good. Let's go, Billy.
Thank you.
Okay, so you're Alex, right? Or,
yes.
Yeah, and you made this song?
Yes, I did.
Okay, well, we just wondered, how did you make this song, and, like, why?
Well, the reason I really made this song was I was feeling really cruddy that day, and I just wanted to basically put, like, how I was feeling, like, all that sad, like, emotion into one little song showing that, you know, you could be happy, but then you can be sad, and put it all into one.
Well, did you do this before you started this class? Like, did you feel the same way, or did you think this class really taught you a lot more about how to put your feelings into something like that?
I would say that the class kind of really helped me, mm-hmm. because it was like I could show, like, emotion into the song, but when I wasn't, it was like nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I couldn't really show emotion at all.
Well, what was your favorite part of this song? Like, maybe the beats that you did, or, you know, something in there?
I really liked the part where, like, just mostly the beginning and the end.
Mm-hmm.
Just how it began, like, kind of slow, and then it ended kind of slow. And the middle, it was okay.
Well, do most of your songs, like, different kinds?
Most of my songs do sound like that.
Mm-hmm.
But some I actually have that are kind of techno-ish.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So. Well, I think the next song we're going to be playing is from Laura. Do you want to say something about your song?
Well, not really. Said, like, just enjoy it as much as I did.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I think we're ready, Billy.
Oh,
Okay, thank you. Wow, you know what, Laura? That song had us all dancing in here. Mm-hmm. And could you tell us a little bit about it? Like, why? How did? What like brought your mind to do this? Awesome piece.
Well, at the time I was thinking about like what other songs I've heard and kind of like put their ideas into my own song. And I was also thinking about like something that is my own.
Cool. That sounds cool. Does this song have a name of yours?
I think it's called Just Story.
Story. Cool. I think that Katrina, the one who started this interview with, has a couple more questions for you guys, if she wants to take it away here.
Yep. So, hi again, you guys. And I have a question for your teacher. What's your favorite part about teaching?
About teaching in general or teaching this class?
Teaching in general.
That's a hard question. That's a really hard question. I just like hanging out. I mean, you know, you're a teacher and they're the student, but, like, you spend enough time with people and you start to appreciate them and get to know them for more than just, like, I don't know, getting beyond kind of the normal sort of student-teacher thing. I think our school, with being sort of smaller and smaller classes, sort of affords that luxury a little more than maybe bigger schools where there's, whatever, 35, 40 people in a class. But, I mean, being able to come down here with these guys and just sort of hang out and laugh and, I don't know, just the sort of getting to know people, I think, and is the best part for me.
Mm-hmm. And Alex and Laura, what's your favorite part about learning from this wonderful teacher?
Well, my favorite part about learning from him is, like, getting to know a teacher and just like what he said, like going beyond that student teacher thing and just like getting to know like other things about him and just like having fun with him and just not like see him as a teacher who just teaches and not have any fun at all.
Cool. And Alex, what's your favorite part about learning?
Well, my favorite part about learning with Tyler is...
Be nice, dude.
Well, he can be funny. I mean, not most teachers aren't like that. I mean, we have one that's, like, boring, and then you have Tyler. I mean, he's, like, awesome, funny, and he knows when to stop joking and then when to joke. It's awesome.
It's cool. I can tell you guys are really passionate about your music. Were you this enthusiastic when you started? Like, what did you expect out of this class when you signed up? And did it turn out like you thought it would be?
Well, I was, like, really kind of nervous at first because I didn't know what to expect, but when I got into it, it was like really fun, and it wasn't really what I expected at all, and it just got me like broadening my horizons about the music world and just doing what I like and being creative.
I was expecting like a lot more, but actually, as I got to know the program, I found out that it's what I was looking for in the class. And, I mean, it helps with a lot of things that I do.
Cool. I guess that'll conclude our interview, and here's Zoe.
Okay, so is there anything else you wanted to say about your piece before we go on to the next one? I think we have one more song to play, right?
Yeah, we got one more. It's by a student named Alex, who's not here. I mean, we may be running out of time. We might fade out with it.
Yeah, okay.
A different Alex. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
You are here, Alex. My bad. So, yeah, thanks, KB. This was fun.
Okay, let's fade out with the song.
Thanks for listening to The Underground. The Underground is hosted every fourth Wednesday of the KBOO Youth Collective. We meet every Wednesday at KBOO at 6 p.m. to plan our show. If you're interested in getting involved, come on down or call our youth advocate, Aaron Yankee, at 503-231-8032 or email advocate@kboo.org. We also do a music show, Youth Randomonium, the last Friday of every month around 10 to midnight. We're always looking for music by anyone under 21 of any style. And check out our website at kblyouth.org. Next up is Hard Knock Radio with David D. Thanks for listening.
Greetings, Cascadia. My name is Steve, and this is the KBOO Community Calendar for Wednesday, February 25th, 2009. Are you an atheist? Meet local atheists, agnostics, secular humanists, scientific naturalists, and other friends of reason for conversation and friendship at the Beaverton Atheist Meetup, Wednesday evenings at 7 p.m. at the Moonstruck Chocolate Cafe in Beaverton Town Square. The meetings are informal and social. Conversation is spirited and polite. For more information, visit www.atheists.meetup.com/542. Come on down to the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue, that's 11th and Clay in Portland, for Tango Passion. Music and dance performed by international harmonica virtuoso Joe Powers, accompanied by the special guest pianist from Tokyo, Naoko Aoki. Joe has recently won the classical division, ranked number one in the world, in the Crystal Harmonica Contest. Naoko is considered by many the best tango pianist in Japan, joined by Argentine tango dance master Alex Krebs. This show is a benefit for the Center for Japanese Studies at Portland State University. For more information, call 503-222-2031. The Mount Tabor Presbyterian Church continues their weekly Divorce Care for Kids programs to help children heal from the pain of divorce and separation. Everyone is welcome every Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. The Mount Tabor Presbyterian Church is located at 5441 Southeast Belmont Street. Information and links are at the church website, www.mounttaborchurch.net. Get your free food every Wednesday at the Food Not Bombs Produce Share in Southeast Portland. Help yourself to free produce, tofu, and other items gleaned from local natural food stores and suppliers. The Produce Share is accessible between 3 p.m. and 9 p.m. Produce Share items are in boxes and tubs on the front porch of 5224 Southeast Boise, Portland, just off of 52nd Avenue between Foster and Holgate. Folks traveling by bus can use TriMet Routes 71 or 14. Simply show up, take what you need, and remember to respect the privacy of the house residents. Please try to arrive before 9 p.m. This has been the KBOO Community Calendar for Wednesday, February 25th, 2009. Thanks for listening. If you support full-strength, volunteer-powered, homegrown community radio, then browse on over to www.kboo.fm and click Join Now.